Let us pause in life's pleasures and count its many tears while we all sub sorrow with the poor. There's a song that will linger forever in our ears. Oh, hard times come again no more. 'Tis a song, the sigh of the weary. Hard times come again no more. Many a days you have lingered around my cabin door. Oh, hard times come again no more. While we seek mirth and beauty and music, light and gay, there are frail forms fainting at the door. Though their voices are silent, their pleading looks will say, oh, hard times come again no more. 'Tis the song, the sigh of the weary. Hard times come again no more. Around my cabin door. Oh, hard times come again no more.
Mavis Staples of the famous Staples Singers, recording in 2004 in Nashville, Tennessee, Hard Times Come Again No More, a song written by Stephen Foster, one of the oldest known American songwriters. Foster died at the age of 37 in 1863. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it is Free Your Mind Friday. This is where you get to take the conversation wherever you want it to go, and hopefully you have an opinion, and a strong opinion, and one that you can defend. That's the whole point of this. 888-874-4888. This was one heck of a week, as you know. So there should be no lack of opinions about it. Henry from Chicago, you start us off today. How are you doing?
All right. How's it going, Eutrice?
Okay.
Okay. Can you hear me good?
I can.
Okay. Okay. All right. The other day you asked us if we were ready. And I think I know what you're talking about. But in my observation, the answer is no. We are not ready. We're not ready to confront this issue. We're not even prepared to confront this issue, especially the issue with, you know, the police terrorism that our neighborhoods are undercoming. We don't have a strategy. And plus, for one thing, like you said, we're not ready. We are not ready as a community to basically give up our lives to fight this problem. And I'm not necessarily talking about death or anything like that. I'm talking about when you talk about real activism, all right. Real activism means that you have to give up your normal life. I mean, we all we're all kind of like integrated within the system where, you know, we got good jobs. You know, we got, you know, good things going on. You know, they give us a little money here and there. But in all honesty, there's just too many of us who are not ready to give up those lives yet. So when you asked that question, I was like, no, we're not. And I mean, even myself included, you know, it's like, because the thing is that, you know, we all have families that we're trying to take care of and we all have a way of living. But, you know, at the same time, there has to be a number of full-time activists who are, you know, who are, like I said, willing to give up everything that they have right now to confront this problem and to deal with this issue.
Well, so what is about to happen, you think, in as much as that we have so many people who are not ready to do that? What do you think will happen?
Well, I mean, there's going to be another police shooting. There's going to be, you know, saber rattling in the community. You know, there's going to be protests. And at that point, you know, basically it's going to be, you know, business as usual. I don't see a plan, a strategy of what we need to do when stuff like this happens, because, you know, I think you elaborated very correctly in regards to the shooting the other day in Sacramento, where the victim's brother was basically acting in a way where it was not very productive. And I mean, me myself, I don't try to demonize him for that. But the thing is that, you know, he has no other outlet to do this. And I'm not making an excuse for him or anything like that. But this is the result we have. This is the reality we have to deal with here. So until it gets to a point, and I'm not saying, I guess what I'm saying is, you know, you had Altimatics on the show, and you know, he always says there's three things that that we can deal with in regards to facing this issue. And these are the language that white people only listen to: money, violence, and the law. Now, to me, myself, I don't think the law is enough. So it's either got to be money or it's got to be violence. And we're not ready to do either one of them, because the first of all, like, you know, like you elaborated before, you know, we'll spend billions of dollars to go watch Black Panther, but we won't spend a dime to liberate ourselves. I think somebody in my circle had mentioned that we spend more money to be enslaved than we are to free ourselves. And obviously, with violence, we're definitely not ready for that. So, yeah, I don't see anything in the horizon that, you know, would help us.
Well, let's see what people are thinking out there. Let's see if they react to what you're offering today, Henry. Thanks so much for calling and getting
Thank
us
you.
Started. Travis from Buffalo, you're on the air.
Hello, beautiful one, you chief. How you doing?
I'm okay, Travis. How about you?
I am doing well. Thank you for asking. I had a couple things that I wanted to try to touch on, if you would give me a second to just, you know, get in order. For the first thing, I know that we've had conversation about this gun law and the gun debate thing. Me personally, I don't feel like, I know that former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court said that we should do away with the Second Amendment. In my personal opinion, I don't think that we should, or that would be beneficial to us. I don't think that we can legislate ourselves out of the predicament that we are in, especially when it comes to gun violence. It's more of a cultural and mental thing. We are morally bankrupt society. And I don't think that changing these laws will change the behavior of people. I think that it would find the people that are doing these killings will still find some way or somehow to do whatever it is which is really on their heart and mind to do. Like, we've seen people change laws in the past, and they haven't really done anything. We've seen, you spoke about, you know, the sister, I think her name was Lorraine Brown, about the Brown v. Board of Education case, and there was legislation
Linda
that
Brown.
was, Linda Brown, Linda excuse Brown. me, there was, you said Linda, right?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, there was legislation involved with that as far as desegregation, but we are even worse today than we were back then. So I don't think that legislating ourselves out of this, trying to legislate ourselves out of this gun issue is going to work. The second thing that I wanted to talk about was, I know you made some comments yesterday about the young brother that was pretty much, I don't want to say acting a fool, but pretty much put on, you know, a little bit of a spectacle at the city council. And I feel like, I think that we should have just been a little bit more understanding of, you know, what the young brother was dealing with and what he was going through. Me personally, I can no way in any shape or form understand, you know, what he's dealing with, having to deal with your brother being shot at or shot 20 times by the police office, by a police. And I think that we were looking at it as an isolated event. I say that in regards to, like, when people give credit or give understanding to Army people or soldiers that come back with and, you know, are dealing with PTSD in some form or fashion, and we give some type of understanding to them to, you know, how they're trying to cope and deal with coming back from war and whatnot. And I think the young brother, I think we were looking at it, it was just him, but it could have been like just dealing with just the whole culture of what's going on in the world today. And he was expressing himself, not just because of, you know, his situation with his brother, but from a general and a macro standpoint, seeing black men get killed every day, seeing no justice being served. I think mentally that does something not only to him but to us as a people. And I feel like we shouldn't label or direct people how to grieve. I'm not saying that what he did was the best thing, but I'm trying to say that we should have been, or we should be, especially as a people, more understanding for, you know, dealing with for people dealing with situations like that.
I'll tell you how I read that situation. I read the situation that as the cameras being on, and this was his time to shine and his time to do his thing. And he looked like a fool, plain and simple. There's no excuse about it. You don't behave, especially in these kinds of circumstances. You do not give people a reason to be critical of you. You just don't do it. And that was a signal that nobody was counseling this young man or the family as a whole what to expect, how to conduct yourselves. When he got up on the dais and put his butt literally in the face of city council members, several of whom were black and women, it was all over for me. There was no reason for it. Now he is saying, I owe the mayor an apology. No, you don't owe the mayor an apology. You owe your people an apology. You owe your community an apology, because that's how we saw you, as part of a community that was misbehaving and representing our community. I understand all about PTSD and all of that stuff. I'm not belittling that at all, and I'm not suggesting that he might not be still in some kind of shock. But nobody could convince me that he didn't know at the time he was doing it, it was rotten behavior. And he ought to be ashamed of himself. It looks like he's ashamed of himself. But it also says, whoever is counseling the family. This is what I'm talking about. Some way, somehow, there has to be a protocol devised, a general kind of advisory, because it appears that we need it in the black community more than other communities, the black and Latino communities, how we are to conduct ourselves. so that we don't jeopardize. It may very well be the case that his behavior basically would have encouraged members of the city council and the mayor, who could have been of help and who still can be of help, turned off. Nobody wants to be insulted and on camera, because the cameras are on. You're performing, not even remotely aware of what you're doing. Somebody has to be held responsible for that. He's a grown man. And I certainly understand these kinds of losses. I've covered so many of these cases. I understand it. I understand grief, and that you can't legislate to people how they should grieve, but you certainly should be able to advise them about how to behave if you're looking strategically at what has to happen now. You need more friends than you ever had before. You need help from a system that you're fighting. You still need some people in there who might be helpful to you. You need the sympathy of people. You don't get it by behaving this way. So he needed some heavy counseling, as far as I'm concerned. Put him in a room and read him the Riot Act, because it is very possible that he could be making matters worse in terms of the outcome of this case. I've seen a lot of this happen before.
I understand what you're saying. I respectfully disagree.
Okay.
I'm just saying.
I know. I respectfully agree that we disagree. But I thank you so much for offering your thoughts so freely with us today. That tells me it's a very, very great comfort that the program is safe for those who agree and those who don't agree. Thank you so much for calling in. Leona from Michigan, you're on the air.
Greetings, Yatrice, and greetings to your audience. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, and greetings to you,
hear me
too.
Okay? Hello?
Yes, I'm listening.
Oh, okay, sorry. Three things I want to touch base on right quick. One was the Dred Scott decision, and another was Lewis Clayton Jones, and the other one I'll remember in a second. March 6, 1857, according to my research, that was the day that the Dred Scott decision came down from the U.S. Supreme Court. And this is the 161st anniversary of that decision. And that decision, of course, among other things, Judge Roger B. Taney said that persons of African descent cannot be, nor were they ever intended to be, citizens under the U.S. Constitution. Or in other words, a black man has no rights that a white man is bound to respect. And that's one thing. This case with the white boy who killed 17 people and didn't get a scratch from law enforcement, and then Stephen Clark, who had a cell phone and got shot 22 times dead by law enforcement. In terms of Lewis Clayton Jones, I recently came across some of his work. I know that you, well, I believe that you knew that brother. And
yes.
He said one of the things, I finally got hold of a copy of one of his books, but I had to borrow it, and it came all the way from the Library of Congress. Could not find a copy of that brother's work. But I wanted to ask you if you could help me get some of his work. But before that, here's a quote from Lewis Clayton Jones that I found very moving, among other things. He said that, quote, he said, "During the 60s, I, like most black middle-income Americans, participated in civil rights demonstrations, joined the March on Washington, and did all the other things that a good black, quote-unquote, citizen was expected to do at that time. Although extremely critical of the status quo and often bitter in its denunciation, in the back of my mind, there was always a belief that, given time and intellectual struggle, this nation would come to its senses and accept the black man as a human being. I no longer believe that. This collection of essays, letters, and speeches is a record of one African's intellectual odyssey from a glimmer of hope in the possibility of change, and even the positive participation of black citizens in that change in the United States, to a deep and abiding commitment to the destruction of the rotten economic and political foundations of what I am now convinced is an irredeemably corrupt system. We have been here almost 400 years. Enough is enough, end quote. And that's from his book, 1981, titled Enough is Enough, a collection of articles, letters, and speeches of Lewis Clayton Jones. This brother also talks about citizenship, again, coming off of the Dred Scott decision, and how he argues, from my understanding, for black people to think that they're citizens in this country is to be like Alice in Wonderland. Because he says that, if the 14th Amendment was true and accurate, and, why would there be a need for a 15th Amendment? And also, why would there be a need for the Civil Rights Act of 1866, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act, and the thousands of lawsuits, spanning hundreds of years, in which the status of the African as a student, voter, worker, and human being had to be debated and decided by one racist Supreme Court after another. He who argues...
Well, here's a point that he's making, and it is the forever point, and he cites the Dred Scott decision. It made it clear. Roger B. Taney, writing for the majority, basically was undergirding the attitude of the court. Black folks have no rights, period. And that was the official ruling of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And it was buttressed by all the lower courts. It was buttressed by popular culture and opinion. And so I agree with Clayton, who passed away some years ago. But I agree with Clayton Jones on this matter, because even today we have two systems of rights. We have natural rights, which whites have, and then we have civil rights, which derive strictly from the prevailing views of people as they interpret the U.S. Constitution. Blacks have no natural rights in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about rights in blacks, we necessarily have to go through elaborate reinterpretations of the U.S. Constitution. And the U.S. Constitution, the Dred Scott decision was a landmark decision in this regard. It affirmed that blacks have no natural rights. You have no natural rights. Whites do. Blacks have no natural rights. None. Every right that African Americans have had to fight for, they have had to wage essentially a constitutional war. Whites never have had to prove their qualifications under what they understood to be their natural rights. I'm a white man. End of story.
Yes, ma'am.
So this is an ongoing issue, and it's a major cleavage, I think, in the law. And it is worth, I think, for legal scholars to raise this question, because here in this situation, it pertains to the the situation in Sacramento. The person who was shot dead has no rights. The cops who kill him do have rights. See, we have to argue now. It has to be debated whether the young man has rights or had rights, and whether his rights were to supersede the rights of the police. You have the police having more rights than him. He does not have natural rights. Mm-hmm. So this is a thing that has persisted throughout the years about natural rights and civil rights. They're not the same.
Okay.
You mentioned Louis Clayton Jones, and one of the things I want to say about him and the brother who I knew, also William Augustus Jones, the pastor of Bethany Baptist Church. I used to joke with him and say, you don't need an organ here for the low notes that, you know, would make the church tremble. His voice was exactly like that. When he spoke and went down to the lower registers, it was like the voice of God itself. And he was always so clear about the role of a pastor. He was very proud of that. And he was very proud of the role of the church, or the potential role of the church, in liberation of people. Louis Clayton Jones was a lawyer as well. And for many years, he was a co-publisher of the New York Amsterdam News. So he had a sense of journalism as well. So his writings were informed both by his acuity in the law and in journalism as well, which is why I think his writings would be of great interest. Mm-hmm. Thanks for bringing that up.
Yes.
Thank you, Fiona. Let's go to Jay from New York. You're on the air.
How are you, Latrice?
Okay, how are you doing, Jay?
I'm good. Listen, I'm going to be quick. I'm just basically calling in regards to the case out in Sacramento. I've been going back with this ever since back in the day of Clifford Glover. And I'm just at the point right now to where as the Crumps and the Sharptons are nothing more than ambulance chasers. They're not bringing forward any type of solutions to these incidents at all. And the only way that I feel there will be any sort of remedy to these incidences, there must be a civil trial. Some family has to sacrifice what has happened to their family member.
I want, as odd as it may seem, because I've been very critical of Reverend Sharpton's role in several of these cases, and also the role of the lawyer, Benjamin Crump. Look, say what you will, as negative as you think their roles might have been, they're what we have.
I understand
they're what
that.
We've got. And I am not going to just throw them out with the baby with the bathwater and say they're no good and the ambulance chasers. Well, they weren't ambulance chasers in most of the cases that they took on because people called for them and they responded.
Yeah, but the thing is, Utrice, we're at a point now in our development as a people, or we should be, where we as the community are going to have to stand up and demand certain forms of justice. We're going to have to, as they say, the elders direct the tribe.
What is your or else? You're making demands.
Clearly and simple, my or else is that we as the people do not support it. We have to get to the point to where, as we say to Mr. Crump and the family, that no, we cannot take a settlement. We have to take this thing to trial so that it could be viewed by the world, and in the process, there could be some sort of change.
Let me finish the point, please. Are you coming to the table
Let me tell you what I'm coming with the table is. I'm coming with the table of 30 years of support from the community, 30 years of nothing being resolved in these incidents, and the fact that I believe, this is my belief, that if you take it to trial, they will do way better than what they will do with the settlement. And then at that time, you will put this.
So far, what you're telling me is that you don't have as thorough an understanding of this process as you should. They're not in charge of whether a case comes to trial. That's only theoretical.
I'm talking about civil.
The state attorney general.
I'm talking about civil.
You're talking about a civil case?
Yeah, those are the only things that these lawyers like Crump are able to put forward is civil cases. I'm clear about it's up to the DA and the other forms of government in regards to a prosecution. I'm saying we need to deal with this civilly because we're not going to get no justice in regards to criminal or anything of that nature. Oh, excuse me if I didn't make myself clear from the beginning. I'm talking about civil. I know we're not going to get no redress in the courts in regards to this. But, hey, if O.J. and the Goodmans and the rest of them could get redress against O.J., then I think we should be able to get the same type of redress in civil matters. That's what I'm
but
talking about.
But they got redress, and you have to, again, pay attention to the routine, the scheme of things. That comes after a criminal finding. O.J. Simpson was found guilty, and then they went after him civilly.
Yeah, but you treat Benjamin Crump and the rest of these attorneys come in with the premise of dealing with this thing civilly. They don't come in trying to direct anything criminally. The only lawyer I ever saw coming at a beginning of a case and moved on that level with Alton Maddox here in New York with the, I think it was Michael Stewart, if I'm not mistaken. That's the only lawyer I've ever seen come in and address the issues at hand in regards to criminalization. And I guess with Michael Griffin also.
But these lawyers deal on civil. I agree with you on the issue of, and it speaks to my point that I made and have been making, we have no sense of how in these kinds of cases in which we are asked to participate one way or the other, we are asked to support it by protests and marches and donations and so forth. So we are asked, a public participation is asked. But we don't get to guide the cases. We don't get to understand from them what their strategy is. We know only that the outcome
they don't have
is
none.
Routine. No, it's a routine. The outcome right now, you can pretty much sit in your house and predict how this case in Sacramento will turn out.
But that's why I'm saying we need to change the narrative. It's very, very clear. But no, you treat, you got to listen. It's very, very clear whenever most people think of cases like this, they feel as though we have to address it in a criminalization manner. But the reality is that the players, when I speak about the players, I'm talking about the Sharpens and the rest of them, are not going to put the necessary pressure that Alton Maddox did on the system. So this is why I'm saying we have to change the narrative so that people understand, first of all, we're not going to get no justice in the criminal side of this, but we need to call upon the family and the attorneys to stand strong, don't accept the settlement, and now let's take it to trial civically so that information could get out. And get in the process, as we move forward, I think we will be able to change the paradigm on how these situations move forward. Because I'm clear, we're never going to get no justice in regards to criminally until we can address and expose these police only through, I believe, civil court in the manner in which we must. That's just my position. You may think I'm wrong, but I think I'm at the point that's the direction we need.
Yeah, but you might be a little bit off the mark.
I don't think I am. You may feel that way, and I know you have experience.
I'm explaining why I think you're a little bit off the mark. You have to understand the process. And in this process, you have to understand what it takes to gather all of the things that would make a case outside of the system. The system holds all the cards right now. What you're talking about, and you may not realize it, is that a massive investment has to be made by the community to fund independent investigators, independent lawyers working under the supervision of a very experienced lawyer. Who is doing that? You have to get people to assemble information and evidence. Who's doing that? You know, few people recognize or believe even that in the cases that Alton Maddox has undertaken, that in many instances have set legal precedents. He was the one funding the investigators. He was the one assembling independent teams to get independent evidence that would clearly show who is lying and who is telling the truth. And that costs money. The black community is wretched in this respect. It does not believe in supporting the people who are truly fighting for it. It doesn't believe in that. Instead, we have a situation where the system that you're fighting holds all the cards. And it holds all the cards for one reason only, that the resources are not there to fund an independent effort that would contradict everything that they say, or almost everything that they say. The cards, they hold the cards.
Well, an independent effort
has to be funded. I'm not moving one inch off of this point.
No, Utrice, I'm gonna agree with you. But in order to get us to the point to where, as what you're saying, the community understands it, we have to figure out how we can articulate your point, because your point is absolutely right. I cannot disagree with your point. But what I'm saying to you is, we as a community have to figure out how we articulate this. I'll leave you with this. The example that you just used would be something, unfortunately, back in the day when you was at the City Sun, it would have been able to articulate. At this time, unfortunately, we have no place to articulate the narrative that you just put forward, which, in all honesty, is the right analogy. Somebody has to be able to finance the necessary thing to move forward. I guess you can equate it with the civil rights movement or any other movement. It got to be, as they say, a money man behind it. So, no, I can't disagree with that. But we have to, as a community, figure out a way how we're going to deal with this and how we're going to address it. Because I'm losing interest in it. I'm starting not to care. You don't want people not to care when you see fratricide and genocide against your people. And that's the point that it's coming to.
Sorry, it's not coming. It's been here. It's been
I'm getting to that point.
So we need to find a way to start funding our own liberation. Nothing else suffices. And you have a person with a track record who devotes his entire life representing people for free, no cost. And there isn't a backup for a person like that. And every case he has tried, he has won. And some of the most improbable cases, there's no way this guy could win this case. Yes, he's winning them. But he has had to finance his own way. And that's not right. Thanks for calling. Thanks a lot for your thoughts. Ma'at, you are on the air.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Greetings to the beloved PRN family. First, I want to chime in on something that happened about a conversation from about 2.5-3 months ago, and I didn't get in or I wasn't on the line. And it was a conversation around health and cancer. And I just wanted to mention something that wasn't mentioned is someone like in Italy, Dr. Simonetti, I think his name is, who came up with the baking soda cure, which some people, you know, use themselves a little bit of a good brand. So I just wanted to chime in on that. And the other point I want to make or points is around the murder of Stephon Clark. For one, there's some aspects of it that we can look at specifically, and that is that the police were called based on somebody breaking some auto windows, you know, what is probably essentially a misdemeanor. They wind up in a backyard, and it seems to me that they're so flagrant in terms of being on private property when the cars would not have been in that space. And also a helicopter, I mean, they pull out all the stops with these things. A helicopter was involved, and there's a very super bright light that wasn't being utilized as they were in that peculiar position in a private backyard. It looked like, from what I could see, that the guy was running away from them. So, you know, for their concern about saying he had a cell phone, the cell phone seemed to be pointed in the other direction. So those are the basic points that I wanted, because, you know, there's some good discussion about where we are and what we can do, but I just wanted to point out some specifics of how promiscuous and flagrant these police are in their, you know, trying to stop broken auto windows.
Well, you know, they also had infrared equipment, so they didn't even need the bright lights. They had the infrared equipment, which they also used. The heat sensitive, it picks up the heat of a human's body and
they can follow it. We don't know what the
specifics
are.
The point I'm making around the bright light is you could have seen his posture, his position, because in the video it seems like his back is to them and he's running away from them, and it would have made clear exactly what was happening, and not to mention the helicopter was already on the scene, part of the scene, and the bright light on the helicopter might have started any kind of assault toward the young man, because, again, he seemed to be running away, and the bright light of the helicopter, the point I'm trying to make, would have been clearer. It's always to escalate. It's always they're trained where the gun is the only response, and then 20 shots. It's just beyond the pale.
But, you know, you saw that although they had an aerial unit, they also had the two officers on the ground with more coming to the scene. So there was constant communication between and among them. I don't know, because I haven't seen any account for it yet. I don't know what caused the two officers on the ground, other than they mistook the weapon he had as, the cell phone he had as a weapon. And I don't know what led them to believe that he was about to fire at them. There are all these questions that are still unanswered, in my view. The helicopter police also could see what was going on. And I'm imagining there's some kind of dialogue, an interchange of dialogue between the helicopter unit and the ground units. So even though they had said at one point, turn off or mute the body cams that they were wearing, there's so much to be learned here as to what exactly happened, who said what, who communicated what. In the immediate instance where just before he's shot dead, all those shots, 20, being discharged, what was said to the extent that they permitted their communication systems to continue to run, so there's some evidence that could be gotten from there. Were they just terrified, in a state of terror? And rather than following procedure, basically we're all hyped up to the max. And the shooting was, in fact, a reaction to the terror that they felt. We don't know. And this is why I say, even in this instance, all this time there should have been independent gathering of information. But nobody's funding it. Nobody seems to be conducting an overall, nobody seems to be conducting an overall building of a case here. Go ahead.
Yes. And to me, in a private backyard, it becomes irrelevant whether he had a gun. So how did they wind up there? And I'll continue to listen to the program. Thank you.
Thank you. Did we talk to Bill from New Jersey yet?
No.
Okay, Bill, so then you're on the air.
How you doing, Eutrice?
Okay.
Good.
What are you saying today?
Well, a couple things. It always turns out that what I think I'm going to talk about, as I listen, something else comes up. What I called to talk about was a different perspective on the gun control issue, and my take on that is I am not a gun owner, never been a gun owner, never want to be a gun owner. I think it's the worst invention that's ever been created, and if you think about how different the world would be without the invention of gun, there would have been no slavery in this country without the gun. The Europeans wouldn't have been able to take the country from the indigenous population without the gun, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the gun is a problem, but it's here now. It's never going away because this is how America was founded. This is how the white power structure holds its power. The whole thing of power flows from the barrel of a gun. So the guns aren't going anywhere. Now, here's my little different take on it. I believe that the, you know, NRA aside, the power structure, the power brokers, whoever they are of this country, would like to get guns out of the hands of the people. And the reason they would like to get guns out of the hands of the people is they would like their military and their police and their power structure to be the only ones with guns. There used to be a saying that if you criminalize guns, only criminals will have guns. Well, that is true, and that includes the biggest criminal, which is the U.S. government, will be the only ones that have guns. And you can't have that, because every time people have gunned themselves up, especially brown people, the U.S. government has come to destroy them. MOVE organization, they've got guns, we have to burn them. Waco, they have guns, we have to burn them. Black Panthers, they have guns, we have to put them all in jail and kill them. We can't have these people having guns. We have to be the only ones. And it's no different than America wanting to be the only one that has the nuclear weapon, which are the only ones that you ever used it. You can't have nuclear weapons. Then you would have what we have, and we can't have that. So I believe the power structure really does want to present it to you
and see what you think.
Sure.
The issue with guns today has a dimension that no one is talking about. And that is gun ownership by the sector that has been most virulently advocating for it. Do you know why they want to have guns?
I do.
This is what is really scaring America.
Yes, I do.
They want to have guns in their minds, in the inevitable situation where they have to fight the government.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Fighting black and brown people.
But
they want
exactly
to hold on to
their
guns to fight the government. The right wing in this country is what is scaring everybody. And the rationale for their rabid support of gun laws. I mean, holding on. But it's not said. What is driving this whole argument about guns and gun ownership and Second Amendment rights and whatnot is that there has been a dramatic political and social shift in this country, giving rise to an ultra-right-wing climate that sees guns not just for self-protection, but sees, this is their rationale, that someday they have to fight the government itself.
True.
You think so?
What I'm saying is they're right. That day may come. That day may come.
But you believe that analysis, though, that makes sense to you?
Oh, that's exactly what I called to say. Is that the power structure wants to get the guns out of people's hands because they know the day may come where they might need to fight the people, and they don't want the people to have the same armament that they have. Just like America doesn't want the other countries to have nuclear weapons that they have. We want to be the only ones that have this power.
Since this is such a popular theory, what you would think that the folks who think this way would be propagating their beliefs all over the place. to see if they can start building a movement.
But you know what? It wouldn't be popular to say we need to have these guns because one day we're going to have to fight the government. That's understood, but that's not what they want to say. It's easier to say Second Amendment, you know, hunting, you know, home defense. But in reality, it's one day we might have to, they might come for us like they came for black people lots of times. And we're not going to have that. We're going to have to defend ourselves. And if we don't have these guns, if America has superior guns, we've got trouble.
Wow. Well, there we go. That is, in fact, quite an illuminating response. But I felt that that's really what is behind this whole thing with the gun law.
Absolutely.
And Second Amendment. We need our guns because one day soon, we, the white people with guns, will have to take on the government.
Yes, that's right. And the government
knows that.
That's why whenever they see you stockpiling, we're going to have to burn you. You can't stockpile. Can't have that. Why? Because we say so. That's why.
Wow. Well, what a revelation that is. Thanks so much for your call today. Thank you all for your calls today. Really good things that you put forward for us to consider. And this is why I like Free Your Mind Friday. It is really what radio is supposed to be about. People feeling free and safe in expressing their opinions openly. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus. And we'll see each other on Monday. I hope you have a very enjoyable and calm weekend. We'll see each other Monday. Bye-bye.
While we seek mirth and beauty, and music, light and gay, there are frail forms fainting at the door. Though their voices are silent, their pleading looks will say, oh, hard times come again, oh.